Hello and welcome to this week's installment of Nucleus Investment Insights. My name is Mark and I'll be hosting today's webinar. Today our topic of discussion is why are Australian banks so profitable? Our special guest today is Matt Johnson, principal at Signal Macro. His areas of focus are macroeconomics, central banks, interest rates, foreign exchange markets. Good afternoon, Matt.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, happy to have you here. Our other guest today needs no introduction, Damien Klassen, Head of Investments at Nucleus Wealth. Good afternoon, Damien.
Hi, Mark. So I might jump off straight away by maybe you might want to give us a little bit more of your background, Matt, just in terms of where you've come from, and then we'll jump into sort of some questions. So yeah, we'll hit mainly a lot on the Aussie banks, but also wanted to sort of hit some of the central banking and you've written a few things recently just to, you know, say New Zealand and places like that. I'd be interested to get your thoughts on as well. But why don't we start with your bit of your background?
Yeah, very happy to. So I never wanted to be an economist. I started out studying law and had to take a second degree and did a bit of economics alongside the law and really liked it. And one thing led to another, and eventually I ended up finishing with the economics degree and going off to first of all to make policy in Canberra, and then eventually I found my way, enough wrong decisions, into an investment bank, UBS. Where I spent a dozen years, eventually was the global head of rate strategy at UBS, having started as the head of Australia and New Zealand, which is still my area of greatest expertise. I spent a little bit of time at a hedge fund, Millennium, and then for family reasons, we're now here in Newcastle, and I set up a consultancy by the name of Signal Macro, focusing on my areas of expertise, which is global macro, foreign exchange, and interest rates. I've got a bit of a keen interest in banks, which I suppose is the reason I'm here today. I guess one of the main reasons being that it's been a long time since it was just the interest rate that the central bank sets, which has had the impact on the economy. The central banks are doing all sorts of other weird and wonderful things, as well as regulators. And this is it's the bank balance sheets and these instruments which are used to regulate banks, which had the main, I think, the most important influence on the pass through of monetary policy. So that's my career background, and I'm very happy to talk about any of the topics you mentioned today. I've written a bit about the RBA recently and the proposed review of the RBA, and I think what that means for Australian monetary policy. A bit about the RBNZ, who just started their interest rate increases yesterday, I'm very happy to talk about the changes to the serviceability buffers, which APRA announced yesterday as well. So, open it up.
Well, I thought what I might start with is some of the bank funding, and that's, I guess, given we're titling the video, and then we'll move into some of the central bank stuff later on, because I'm very interested in your views there.
Yeah.
And the reason for getting you on was a piece you'd written earlier, and just talking about, and I think you're sort of behind some of the lobbying. I guess certainly you're certainly visible in some of the lobbying that, say, Chris Joy and others were doing about and ANZ about the bank funding and how much they need to, whether it's all right not to hold government securities, whether it was all right to hold the securities of other banks in that portfolio.
And so, I wouldn't describe myself as a lobbyist. I was aware that there was a debate being held, and I'm a startup in search of profile. So it's sort of it was a fit for my area of expertise. So
do you want to give it a bit of background for people, I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, Chris Joy, I guess the first thing you need to know about Chris Joy is he's a force of nature, and the idea that anyone could put words into his mouth I'm not sure that's I'm not able to do that. That's something. So Chris is his own man, and I'm my own man. I was in need of a bit of profile early on, and there was a debate that was bubbling away about the what's called the CLF, which is a liquidity facility which was made available to Australian banks. And so I wrote on that early on in the piece when I think no one really thought there was much going on, and really my key insight was that it was a subtle point, but if the money that was created via QE was counted as a high quality liquid asset, then APRA could close the CLF basically immediately. And I didn't think they would close it immediately.
Just to give people a little bit more of background to it, sorry, just because for the readers who, for the listeners who want that. So CLF is effectively the RBA helping to get liquidity to banks and helping to shore up their funding by providing
I should unpack it a bit because it's crucial in understanding the decision that was made. So basically, when Basel III was introduced globally, banks were told that they needed to hold more liquidity because regulators are always managing the prior crisis, and the prior crisis was a liquidity shock, and banks didn't have enough of their own liquidity and had to go to the central banks. And so regulators decided that banks should become more self-sufficient, but then in some jurisdictions, and Australia was one of them, they took a look at the size of the banks and the size of the liquid asset markets, and they said, well, golly, if the banks had to, you know, look after themselves in a liquidity sense, then they would have to buy so much of this market that it would cease to be liquid. And then, so in Australia's case, if banks had bought enough government bonds to meet their liquidity outflow needs, then they would have just completely destroyed the government bond market in Australia. And then we would have lost our only liquid asset, which is obviously not good for, obviously has negatives as well. So what the RBA did is they said, okay, well, we'll turn some of these non-liquid assets into liquid assets. And the way we'll do that is that we will promise to be the buyer. But the key thing here is that the CLF, which is that committed liquidity facility, so the RBA committed to buy these assets, committed to make these assets liquid in the case that liquidity was required for a fee. And so they sort of gone from a small pile of liquid assets, and then they've essentially added on another stack of liquid assets by promising to buy them, temporarily buy them via a repo, but buy them nonetheless, or provide liquidity against that security in the case that it was needed. So that therefore they've expanded the universe of liquid assets. But the CLF, you know, the purpose of the CLF was to protect the government bond market from the banks. It wasn't to protect the banks from having to buy expensive liquid assets. And so when you fast forward to today, what we've had is, balance sheets have grown, yes, but the size of the bond market has also grown. And the growth of the bond market is such that banks would be able to look after themselves in terms of the bonds that are available. And so there was another little tweak to do with the way in which RBA QE actually transforms bonds into high-powered money, through a subtle effect, it increases further again the quantity of liquid assets in the system. And really my insight was saying, well, once we take into account the effect that QE has on transforming the quantity of liquid assets, APRA can close this thing straight away. But I didn't think they would. I thought that they would close it in a more phased sense. And then very late in the day, I think the banks made an economically justified but a politically perhaps naive decision to start selling their portfolios of liquid assets. And of course, you know, government borrowing has never been larger. And it suits public policy for banks to buy those bonds because it helps with the cost of funding for the public or for the treasuries, which is the public. And yet banks were selling them down because these liquid assets were now expensive to carry. And I think that was a bit naive. So just, you know, after the Q2 ADI stats were published, I actually moved forward or made my call for tapering more aggressive, which beat APRA by 2 days, saying that it all sort of happened, but it was just good luck. I thought it was a politically naive decision on their part, economically justified, but not seeing the big picture. And I don't know if that's what pushed APRA to make the decision or not, but that's what informed my decision.
And I guess what I want to do is sort of to translate for people why I wanted to get what, you know, part of the reason for getting on is as I'm reading that, you know, it's occurring to me that, you know, one of the mysteries that I've been looking at is why Australian banks are priced so high relative to all their global counterparts, and why as the interest rate curves are flattening around the world, that, you know, European banks, their profitability in particular is getting smashed, and same in the US, and Australia has come down, but it's still quite strong. And one of the pieces is going, well, effectively in Europe, what's happening is the central banks there are you know, they've got negative interest rates. They're effectively trying to keep the banks alive in terms of being able to go, yes, we know we want to try and get interest rates as low as possible, but we know if we flatten the curve too much, we'll certainly all our banks broke, and that's not going to help the situation. So we need to let them be as profitable as possible. As profitable as they need to be to keep lending. Yeah. And I guess what I'm wondering, that they're sort of coming to me is, well, is that just exactly the same as what's happening in Australia, but Australian banks are a lot closer with the regulators, and or the regulators have decided the level of profitability that banks are allowed to have is higher. And so maybe that's why that we see these committed loan facilities and things like that last for a lot longer than maybe they should have, because certainly the Banking Commission discussed a lot about the very close relationship between Australian banks and Australian regulators. And I guess that's where I'm sort of starting this conversation, going, well, are there other areas as well where you think the banks are getting a bit of a free kick in terms of, you know, the notional notional backing of the government for effectively for free to, I think certainly overseas it's looked upon as the Aussie government will step in for the big four if need be.
Well, I suppose that argument could have been made up until the time that APRA made this decision about the CLF. I mean, the CLF, it's not a...
So for the last dozen years, up until what, a month ago, 2 months ago?
I'm trying not to put my oar in too much on that. I think APRA is not the ACCC. APRA is most of all concerned with making sure depositors get their money back.
Yes.
Now, when you talk about the CLF, and they've done a good job of that, that when you talk about the CLF, the Committed Liquidity Facility, it is a fact that as a proportion of liquid assets, the smaller banks were actually much bigger users of the CLF than the larger banks and on their liquid asset side. So if you think about a non-major bank, like that second tier of lenders, like a Suncorp, Bank of Queensland type bank, then what you'll find compared to CBA is that they have a much larger share of their liquidity stack in the CLF. Right. And then again, in terms of competition, one of the effects of the Committed Liquidity Facility was that you could use other banks' senior bond issuance as the collateral for that. And so if you're a foreign bank trying to compete in Australia without a deposit base, you know, Mizuho Bank, for example, I'm sure they were able to issue debt in Australia. It would have been bought by one of the major banks or someone who had needed collateral for the CLF and then used as liquidity there. So I don't think it's true that the CLF was like an anti-competitive measure aimed at increasing the spreads for the big four. Mm. But I do think it had the effect of protecting banks from buying expensive liquid assets, and so was good for their margin. Yeah. But I don't agree that it was I think the facts about the CLF is that the smaller banks were bigger users and they benefit, and probably the smaller banks who have a weaker deposit base has benefited more from this cross-holding of bank bonds. And so I would say that they were a bigger benefit. The smaller end of town was probably a bigger beneficiary of the CLF than the big end of town.
Yeah, I guess, sorry, and maybe I might be sounding overly, I don't know, conspiracy theory about it, but I think it's more in terms of going, and it probably exactly comes back to what you said then, is if something's changed now that, you know, they're saying, okay, we're actually start winding this back, or maybe we'll start adding some things. Then I guess it's more from an investment point of view, going, okay, for the last decade or so, we've had the governments been implicitly or explicitly guaranteeing some of these assets and giving some cheap funding, and so that's why Australian banks have held up better than what you've seen around the world. But if that's changing, then as an investor, we need to know, okay, look, be happy to own them under, you know, with lots of government support. But if that government support's going to be starting to edge away, you know, trip away the edges, then you need to know, because if you're going to get repriced on the same basis as say a European bank. So I guess I'll try not to cast judgment.
I think you can make the case that that there has been a change. And I think whether you're talking about the CLF, which will ultimately have the effect of forcing banks to hold more expensive liquid assets. So I think that'll increase the cost of those liquid asset portfolios and be a drag on net interest margins. That's one example. And then I think, you know, you can think of the, but it hasn't been one way for that entire period. So the regulation of the macroprudential regulations and the regulation of of mortgage lending up until the changes in 2019 were a negative for banks. And then the deregulation, the change in the regulation, so the removal of the 7% floor, the minimum assessment floor, even though it was offset by a larger buffer. I mean, there's, you know, those assessment rates, the average assessment rates for banks have fallen from 7.25% at the start of 2019 to about 5.25% now. And that 200 basis point drop in the serviceability test, that minimum rate, when that's been capitalized into house prices. And the way that works for banks is that's more lending, right? If you can, people can borrow more money, then they're more tempted to upgrade, they're more tempted to trade their home, and obviously they have to pay off more money when the prices go up. So that deregulation, you know, there was a period where things
for most of these is the same anyway. So yeah,
well, they're all. I mean, the Aussie banks are basically big mortgage houses. It's housing that makes all the money. And so what I'm trying to say is that, you know, they were squeezed a little bit prior to 2019. That was bad, and then things were loosened up a bit from 2019 really until today. It's been a path. There's been a steady loosening or a steady improvement in the favorability of conditions under which banks operate. If you take out the COVID shock, which obviously was no good, but you know, the steps that were taken by the regulators at that time, in particular the TFF, were very beneficial for banks. And yeah, I would agree with the proposition that the pendulum's now swinging the other way. The change to the CLF will increase the cost of the liquid asset portfolios, and then the change to the serviceability benchmarks that were announced yesterday, I think, also has the effect of making, you know, lending conditions slightly less propitious for banks, and it does seem like there's probably more to come, and more to come. You know, APRA has said they are going to publish a paper on this. People are largely expecting a change in the, you know, some sort of caps on high debt to income lending, and I think this stuff just works in the background to basically slow mortgage writing by banks. You know, I've talking to brokers, you hear stories of bank discounts already declining. So normally once something like this is announced, the banks are pretty much keen to implement it straight away. So even though it starts at the end of this month, I'd say that if you applied for a mortgage today, and you know you're probably going to be assessed against one of those higher buffers. So it just means, you know, I think the pendulum is swinging the other way, and in general that should be it's not a positive.
Yeah, and so I guess trying to read the tea leaves about what the government's doing, you know, it was probably 2 or 3 months ago they were telling the banks, you know, lie back and think of your country and then lend as much as you can.
Yep.
And now they're saying, oh, well, actually maybe that lending should be actually more responsible.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a I probably characterize this government as being quite pro-housing. Well, and they've even come out and said, you know, house prices will be higher under a Liberal government than they will under a Labor government. So do you feel as if the changes they've made are signaling a significant change in the overall policy, or is this just a tactic, but the strategy is still keep the lending going and try and keep houses pry and buy, and maybe we need a few...
I think the political truth is that if you make house prices go up, you normally get re-elected. So I think that remains true. So I would guess that the political strategy of the government should remain favourable to house prices. Having said that, it's no secret that if you make house prices go up, you get re-elected. So it's probably bipartisan political strategy in Australia.
Oh, absolutely.
Not to say that, you know, things can't go awry, because they clearly can, but all the parties don't from time to time have strategies which go against that. But the dominant strategy in Australia seems to be to make people's house prices go up. So I think that's true. In terms of the specific changes that were announced, I mean, there's two lines of defence in terms of mortgage serviceability. One is a thing called the minimum interest rate floor, and then the other is the buffer. So banks tend to have a minimum interest rate which they assess your ability to repay against, and they get to set it themselves now after the 2019 reforms. That's somewhere between 5 and 5.25, and they were adding on the buffer of 250 to those rates. And so the rates people lend at, or the product rates, are around 2. You had 250, you got to 4.5, which is a bit below 5.25, and so And it's still going to be true, even adding on three, that you'll still be a bit below those rates. So, but that's for owner occupiers. Now, investors, on the other hand, tend to pay a bit more. And so when you add on those rates and you push up the bigger buffers, then for the investors, these things should bite. So what's the political strategy? I think it's protect first home buyers, probably, and try and push investors out of the market. Because, whilst it's true that making house prices go up is generally good political strategy, it's also true that there's been, I don't know how many inquiries into first home ownership in Australia. Basically, too much of a good thing equals yet another Productivity Commission inquiry into first home ownership, which will not come to any action conclusions. The report's been written before. They just take the cover off and put a new one on. I used to work at the Productivity Commission, so I got
sick. Yeah, guys. These are all the things we told you to do last time that you haven't done.
Yeah.
Why don't you do them this time?
Yeah. So they're much the same findings, but so too much of a good thing is bad because first home buyers don't like it. So I think the political strategy is probably to try and keep investors pushed back. And if you read APRA's explanation of the changes that were made, they really say that they went for the buffer instead of the floor because it'd have a bigger impact on investors. And that is that, as I explained, the product rate's a bit higher for investors. So product rate plus buffer gets you above that floor already. And so you push up the buffer a bit. And so their minimum rate or their serviceability rate for investors is going to be, it will go up. Whereas for owner occupiers, I mean, the price leader in the market right now, and I don't get paid commission by Macquarie, but I think it's Macquarie at about 2.14% or 1.5%, whatever the advertised rate is, but around that level. So you add on 300 to that, you get to just under 5.25%, and the market seems to be using about 5.25% for the assessment rate. So probably for owner occupiers, it's not much different. What this will protect against, I suppose, is any further erosion of those minimum rates towards the product rate plus the buffer rate, which seems to have been the trend since 2019. Like if you look at a chart of those assessment rates, they just drop from 7.25% down to 5.25%, a little bit each quarter.
And it seems to me that the typical Aussie housing cycle goes, first home buyers all jump in there and push prices up a bit, and then investors follow afterwards and give it that extra shove. So if you'd sort of made the argument that I think it's certainly been a big flip around towards more owner occupiers since COVID.
Yeah.
This potentially puts a lid on that next sort of wave sort of pushing through of investors then. Is that what you
I think that's what they're trying to do. And I think that the next phase will be debt to income caps, and that now we have comprehensive, or in theory we have comprehensive reporting of data across the banking sector. Like if you with interest rates so low, you could, in theory, buy a house that will pay itself off because the yield on the house is enough to more than fully service the mortgage. But obviously, you'll add maybe you add $1 million of debt at the same time as you add whatever it is, $60,000 a year of income associated with the renting of the property. Now, if you could stack those things up once upon a time, but if you have DTI caps, then your debt to income, because you're only adding 60K of income for $1 million of debt, your DTI will just explode. So I would assume that DTI caps plus this bigger buffer, and they may increase the buffer again, those two things will both have a pretty marked impact on investors. So it does seem to me like they're going after them. I think, there's not a lot of, and you can see this in New Zealand as well. I mean, first home buyers are generally a protected species. Everyone loves higher house prices until they think about their kids and then they start worrying about first home buyers. No one sheds a tear for the poor old investor.
No, that's right.
So that's the political strategy. I mean, it is less favourable for banks that you would think. But they're making good money. So,
well, that's if the houses are growing and you're lending lots of money to. Everyone gets to upgrade from $1 million mortgage to a $1.1 million mortgage, then the banks will still be doing all right.
I think the government would be very happy with 5% house price growth per annum and fewer investors and more first home buyers, and no political backlash about high house, or less political backlash about high house prices and people getting locked out of the market. My guess is that's the strategy.
Yes. Right. Okay. So New Zealand then. So they've obviously attempted a number of different macroprudential sort of things to try and slow their housing market down with. I'm assuming it's been somewhat it's managed to rein it in from what would have just been even higher.
We don't know what the baseline was. Yeah, you could always claim success against the unseen baseline.
Exactly, but they're still rising, and so
a lot. Yeah. So, I mean, New Zealand's an interesting example. I think what's the housing market has been hotter there than in most places, and I think that it's a product of two things. One is they still have quite high deposit rates, and so there's not a very developed financial market. There's not much of a corporate bond market to get into. And so New Zealanders have used term deposits, and they had very high TD rates in New Zealand, and no one really wanted to lower them because banks have a fairly modest share of deposit funding in any case. And so the question for monetary policy was, how do we get these TD rates down? And that's really what made negative rates in New Zealand quite like an effective monetary policy tool, because, you know, given the cash rate, the spread over the cash rate or the expected cash rate of these TD rates is very, very high. And so I guess the RBNZ had a look at that and said, well, you know, no one seems to want to discount, or it's a very slow process. So if we leave that spread over the expected OCR the same, then if we just pull our OCR negative, then it comes down and we can get down to TD rates that are more normal in Australia or in other jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, people don't really like negative interest rates or lower TD rates. And I think the talk of that really frightened Kiwis but it sharpened the incentives to move into Kiwi housing. And so, you know, in retrospect, they also got rid of all their macroprudential measures, which they were carrying up until the time of COVID. Because they, you know, everyone understands that housing is a transmission mechanism for monetary policy. And so removal of the curbs plus talk of negative rates plus this different financial system where really there's not many alternatives to housing as an income producing asset, plus the favourable tax laws, it really encouraged a stampede into the Kiwi housing and has pushed prices up a lot, like a lot. And there was some changes this year on the taxation side, which was supposed to make housing less favourable, which slowed the market for a while. But I think the reality of very low rates, ultimately just pushed money back into the market. And outside of the capital cities, you still get a pretty good yield as well. So buying for the long term for a bit of yield and for some capital growth with no capital gains tax remained a pretty good proposition. The political strategy of the government, I think, has been, again, protect first home buyers. And so when you look at the announcements that are made by Grant Robertson from time to time, there's been the back and forth between Robertson and the RBNZ about tools, then you really got the sense that first home buyers were to be protected. And also there's a bit stronger wealth effect between housing and consumption in New Zealand. So, you know, the economic and political strategy there, I think, is house prices not down, and less investors and more first home buyers, please. So similar to where I think we're ending up in Australia, and I guess culturally we're similar, but New Zealand, I think, is more advanced. The RBNZ keeps layering on more and more LVR restrictions and other tools, and they didn't have DTI rules or powers in New Zealand, and so that's just been sorted out. I think they would have seen having been a bit of an oversight back in the day where macroprudential rules were first figured out. And so they've just been given those powers. I think they'll use them.
Oh. Seem to have lost him in. Sorry. Oh, there he is.
That's what you do when I talk too much.
Yeah, no. I was checking a question and I accidentally hit the wrong button. Sorry about that. Where I was getting to, I guess the question I wanted to ask on that front is, so that New Zealand's raised its rates yesterday, the day before.
Yeah.
And in what way do you think, or do you think that's potentially a preview of where Australia is going? Or I guess where do you think the major differences are in terms of how long until Australia actually gets to the stage? We're talking about years, and I think you've spoken as well about the whole the whole review of the RBA potentially even extending it a little bit longer.
Yeah.
So people are drawing progressing?
I think that the housing mandate. So there was a change to the remit, not the act, to say they must take housing into account. And I think the politics of housing over there, they got too much of a good thing. Like I was saying before, that first home buyers getting locked out of the market is a problem in Australia as well. In New Zealand, they had too much of a good thing at the end of last year, really, and that I think that led to I think that hastened the RBNZ's change of stance, which turned out to be a good move economically because things have been tearing since then. But my judgment is that probably hastened the change away from dovish towards more hawkish monetary policy. So I think coming into this meeting, it shades things at the edges a little, and it makes it easier for the RBNZ to justify raising rates because obviously they now say that house prices are unsustainable. There's still momentum in the housing market, and killing that momentum via interest rates is something that we know works. So they're also trying to get on top of it via macroprudential tools as well. As to whether that applies in Australia, well, APRA and the RBA, RBNZ has all the powers in New Zealand. APRA has those powers in Australia and the RBA does not. And that was taken away from the RBA some time ago. But of course, Phil Lowe still chairs the Council of Financial Regulators and presumably his views are important. I don't think that the RBA will raise rates to combat house prices. They've said that they won't. I think it's going to be APRA that does the work there. One reason I don't think they will, you've mentioned my work on the review. I mean, the OECD has said that there should be a review now. It's bipartisan policy. The Labor Party had previously said there should be a review of the RBA for missing their targets. Frydenberg, after the OECD recommendation, said he was open to it. My guess is that you don't get an OECD recommendation that hasn't gone through Treasury already. So probably he knew about it before it was made and approved of it, which is why it was published. That's just my guess. So what would if the review is of the RBA for missing their target, then presumably that increases the cost to the RBA of missing their target going forward, and it would be quite handy for the leadership of the bank and anyone who works there and who wants to be governor one day to get inflation up to target as soon as possible. And so I think that review has the effect of delaying the normalisation of interest rate policy in Australia. I don't think for that reason that the RBA is not going to follow the RBNZ in raising rates, and I'm quite dovish relative to the market. The market expects interest rates to rise at the end of 2022 or the start of 2023. I think it'll probably be 2025 before the RBA is normalising rates. I do know that no one can forecast that far out. I've been forecasting my whole life, it's like those forecasts aren't worth much. But the reason I have that judgment is I think it will take that long for the RBA to get core inflation up around 2.5%, and I think that's the rule that they're using for when they're going to start raising rates.
Yeah, and look, you've got my support on that. We've been very much the lower for longer, and you know that the you need to see wage growth, and if we're going to see a flood of migrants coming back, which it appears we will at some stage, and that's going to push wage growth out a bit longer. But I think you've made an excellent point there that, you know, when you know you have a performance review coming up from your boss, will you work a little bit, you know, will you knock off at 4:45 every day, or will you actually spend a little bit longer to make sure he notices me working? And so I think that's exactly where, from my perspective as well, is that struck a chord with me in terms of saying it does make sense.
That awkwardly for Governor Lowe, because it's true that global inflation went down around the middle of last decade everywhere, but awkwardly for him, that's also the time he took over. And so if you just do, I've done this in a research note I published on my blog, but if you just do some pretty standard structural break type analysis, you find that there's a structural break in inflation around the same time that he takes over. And he could say that, look, it's not my fault, but it's also true that the way these algorithms work, you need a long period of a new number before it identifies a structural break. So even if he had have got it back up in 2017 or 18 and he took over in 16, so presumably that was maybe achievable, then it wouldn't have identified a structural break. And unhelpfully for him, you had this period that's just sort of McFarlane to Stevens, where it was 2.5% except for a short period of the mining boom. And then Stevens got it back down and it was trending at 2.5% again. And then Phil takes over and it drops. So the first thing that a review is going to find is there's this structural break around the time he took over. It may not be his fault, but, gee, it would be a lot easier dealing with that review if inflation was 2.5.
Yeah, that's right. Or if at least he'd, yeah, if he'd come in 2 or 3 years earlier and it was like, oh yeah, it used to be higher and then it was lower, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it's a bit awkward for the RBA. And I just think that increases the cost of making a hawkish mistake such that probably they're going to make a dovish mistake this time, but you know, that's what we do.
Yeah. And so wage growth, what are your thoughts around wage growth in Australia? And so we've obviously seen Kiwi wage growth. That was one of the reasons that they spoke about for lifting rates.
Yeah, Kiwi wage growth is good. I mean, that's helpful. In Australia, there's just not that much of it at the moment. I guess there's institutional reasons that people say the cause. I do note there's been a bit of an increase in union official expectations for wage growth. I think that's probably just a bit of catch up wage growth after a period of low wages. I think my guess is that like most people don't know what inflation is or but they just have experience that there's been a period of low price and wage growth for a long time. And I think it's suggestive of a change in inflation expectations, an unwelcome change. Like the RBA always says they're anchored, as all central banks do. But my guess is that inflation expectations and wage expectations have de-anchored from the target and that it's going to be quite hard to push them back up. So I think you'll need an unemployment rate of around 4% for a sustained period of time to give people the confidence to go and ask for a pay rise. And as you say, if the borders are open and firms are able to import skilled labour once again, it is going to make it tricky to, well, it's going to slow the process once again. So I think it's, I've got the forecast of 2025. That's part of that is that I think it takes a long time to get wages back up to 3. We're kind of 1.75 now, could find 125 basis points, haven't been there for about a decade. People's expectations have changed.
And now US, relative to the US, I suppose that's if we're talking currencies, I'm guessing that inflation is probably the big thing and in interest rate obviously if we're holding rates interest rates lower for longer, looking at low wage growth and consequently low inflation, I guess. It would sound then that you're sort of more bullish US dollar versus Aussie dollar. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's right. The difference between Australia, New Zealand, and the problem Australia's got is really on the inflation side. Like in the US, they've still got a lot of jobs to make up, and of course Australia managed to surpass the pre-COVID high watermark for employment, which is great, but it just hasn't been feeding through into inflation. So it's sort of, we've got the opposite problems. The US is the inverse of Australia. In the US, they've got some wage growth and they've got very high inflation. And if you look at core PCE, which is the Fed's preferred measure, it's clearly above their target and expected to decline back towards the target over time. The same is true in New Zealand, where inflation is clearly above the target. They also have employment through the maximum sustainable level. In Australia, thanks to the Delta shock, we're going to have an unemployment rate that's clearly above full employment and above what's required to push inflation back up, given what I think is a decline in inflation expectations, not just a decline in the Nehru. And in the US, they've got inflation that's clearly above target and that they hope comes back down at the same time as they should have strong employment growth thanks to the reopening. So it's just a very different mix in Australia, and I think that keeps the RBA, it makes the RBA late to the global interest rate normalisation cycle. And as you say, we should expect that would lead to downward pressure on the Australian dollar over time. The other thing is commodities, I suppose, is also interesting or important in terms of determining the Australian dollar. I think the new commodity cycle is that Australian export prices go up when the global economy is weak, because that's when China does the stimulus. And I think we can all probably agree that the housing stimulus in China has peaked, if not coming off a bit. So I would think that the price of the stuff Australia sells, once the spike in coal prices due to the cold and some, I guess, choppiness due to the move to greener types of energy generation.
The question for me as well, sorry, this is a sidetracking slightly, but obviously Nord Stream 2 is coming on and it seems as if Russia all of a sudden isn't exporting anywhere near as much coal or gas as what they were recently, and they need, or they would like Nord Stream 2 to be approved. The timing seems fortuitous if you were trying to convince the EU to accelerate the process. Is it,
Suggesting the Russians might be squeezing the Europeans?
No. Just saying they got lucky. Yeah, they got lucky that was just they happened to be not pumping as much gas just as they needed a thing, and prices spiked. So yeah, there's a.
But I think in the once we get there's some choppiness at the moment due to some energy, perhaps some energy politics, perhaps some bad luck, perhaps some good luck, depending who you're asking. Once that passes, I would think that Australian export prices come down. Because it used to be true that commodity prices went up a lot late cycle. But I think now for steel, it's mostly about Chinese housing and resi. And basically, China steps on the gas, which pumps up resi investment when things are weak. And they seem to have put their foot on the brake a bit recently. And I don't see that changing. So I would think that our terms of trade go down. So Aussie interest rates low relative to global interest rates because the RBA takes a bit longer to normalize due to structurally lower inflation and the looming review, plus I think a trend down in export prices over the next year or so should both keep downward pressure on the Australian dollar.
Yeah.
There's a question that's come in from Lachlan over here. What's a realistic worst-case long-term scenario for our pillar banks? The currency competition, wage barriers to asset prices, asset price growth?
So I guess he's trying to get more towards the thought about
The question sort of is there a limit to how much asset growth the banks can get? Like what I was saying before, like the two drivers of the average mortgage size in Australia seem to be the minimum, what your income is, but how much you can borrow, basically. To make it say more simply, how much you can borrow seems to drive average loan size. And the two things that have driven that are increase in wages in Australia, which is pretty slow, and then this 200 basis point decrease in the serviceability or the minimum rate. Is that sort of the question? So I think the objective of policy is to, at the moment, because wage growth is going to stay pretty slow, is to try and flatten out or maybe slightly decrease that maximum amount that people can borrow. Well, it's to slightly decrease. APRA said it goes down 5%. There are some institutional factors, which means it's probably going to go down a bit less than 5%, but there's probably going to be more macro proof. So I think we should, if you're thinking about the asset side of Aussie banks' balance sheets, like the average loan size is probably not going to go up anymore for a period of time. Wage growth should offset that effect of the tightest restrictions over time, but probably on the next year or two, the effect of policy will be to stabilize that. So it'll just be about volume rather than loan size.
Jumping back to the commodity side, so if let's say I think our last week's podcast was on similar thoughts, I guess, to you. If you took the view that China, as you said, was stamping on the brake this time, we're in for a, we've said, look, 2015 style slowdown looks as a base case, and maybe it goes further, maybe it doesn't, depending upon how committed they are to restructuring. But if you saw, I guess, a bigger downturn than that, and so iron ore prices back into the below the $50, energy prices revert, Australia's thrown open the borders again, so wage growth's really low. Does that mean the RBA then needs to sharpen up and we open up again to the term funding facility and funding the banks directly, or is that, you think, that was yesterday's story and there's something different they're going to do this time around?
It's an interesting question. I mean, the TFF, I don't think they'd like to use the TFF unless bank funding becomes strained. So if access to markets is good, they would prefer banks to go to the market. In the case that China's slowing a lot and commodity prices are down, I think the RBA would hope that the currency comes down a lot, and that puts pressure on the and that boosts the non-mining part of the economy. I mean, the transmission mechanism for that would be, because the main mining is a bit of an offshore economy in Australia, not totally, but it's a bit tangential. So one of the main transmission mechanisms is through the budget. So Prices come down a lot, company taxes come down, the budget deficit gets worse, the government tries to rein in spending to try and balance the budget, and that slows the economy down, and we've had a taste of that in prior cycles. What does the RBA do? Well, there should be a bit more debt, and I think the amount of debt has been a constraint on QE. So if you want to get the currency down and there's a bit larger budget deficit because of slower China, I think probably QE is the tool that they'd use. TFF is just a gigantic, you know, you think about it, they loaned $200 billion to banks at a rate that was way below where they could have issued. You know, the difference between those two rates is the size of the transfer to banks, which is so it's not a surprise exactly. They're paying divs and returning capital to investors because they've had a pretty chunky transfer from the taxpayer. So I think doing that again would you need a good justification for doing that once again.
Right. Okay. So that, and that's in which case though. So again, just looking at this sort of scenario, the standard variable rates at the moment are sort of, you know, in the fours, I guess.
Oh, right. Yep.
So you we're really relying on those 3-year mortgage rates of sort of 2% to sort of help that. And so if we've seen, and I guess we've seen the Aussie yield curve sort of lifted in line with the US. And so if we're seeing sort of, let's say the US is getting better and the 10-year rates there are sort of getting up to, I don't know, 2 or 3%. And you're in this scenario where Australia is lagging the rest of the world. Do you think the bond rates will at some stage need to decouple, or do you think actually lead to mortgage rates rising? I suppose I'm trying to work out where's the point there.
So two things. I mean, one thing has been true of this year, and that is that, you know, for a time, Australia, New Zealand, and the US curves were all pricing pretty close to each other, and I think the market just didn't really know what to do with the pricing interest rate expectations. And I think one of the reasons for that is I think that a lot of the, you know, when you look at a curve, it's hard to tell how much of it is true central bank policy expectations and how much of it is a risk premium. But I think the risk premium is more correlated across markets than that central bank expectation. So I think risk premium was driving a lot of that correlation in pricing. It's true that Australia and the US have tended to price together. I don't think they should, based on my fundamental view, but they do. So there's an opportunity there or there's a trade. What makes them decouple? I think it's probably the RBA. You know, we've been here before. The RBA just reminding people that they're a long way away from following other central banks. It's hard for them to do it right now because they want to taper. And so they're telling a positive story because they want to get out of the QE game. But once they've tapered, I think that they...
when you say they want to taper, are you talking the US wants to taper or
the RBA? I think it's very, you know, Governor Lowe had a go at pushing back on OIS expectations in the Annika speech last month, and he said directly he thought market pricing was wrong. But you know, the market responds to their tone, and it also responds to what they're doing with policy. And right now, they're talking optimistically, and they clearly want to cut their QE.
Yeah, but part of the problem is exactly what the problem I just had then was, as you said, they want a taper and they're trying to work toward it. That statement applies to the US Fed as much as it applies to the Aussie Bank, which I think is why they, as you said, people
keep pricing the same. I think the Fed wants to taper and hike because they're telling you they do, and the RBA wants to taper and not hike. And so I think the RBA only did QE because everyone else was doing it. And so now everyone else is stopping, they'd love to stop. And now they're going to rely more on forward guidance going forward. And you saw the start of that in the Annika speech where Lowe talked directly about market pricing, but it'll be a while before they decouple. But just lastly, on the Australian side, you make the point, a lot of people fixed at very low rates, in the last year or so. And in 2023 and 2024, those people are going to start rolling off, 2% fixed rates onto whatever it is then. And if you look at the market today, they'd be rolling onto higher rates. So, you know, 50% of the mortgage book or so is fixed, and 50% of people are going to have a 50 bp increase in 2023-24. Like that's a reason for the RBA not to move the cash rate.
Yeah, but I guess by not doing anything, or effectively they're raising, you know,
that's right. Yeah,
raising rates. Yeah, which is
Even have to do anything, and rates are going to go up as people roll off these old low fixed rates onto new higher ones.
And I guess that's where I'm coming from is, well, if the commodity market's falling apart, wage growth isn't going anywhere, and you're looking at effective rate rises, doesn't that sound as if, well, they better get back in and start doing something so that they do, so that people don't get those rate rises?
Well, that's right. I guess that that hits your question about the TFF, you know, because the TFF was an important part of putting downward pressure on those fixed rates. I guess so. I just think they'd be reluctant to get involved unless they could point to something in funding markets, which said that there is an issue, that banks can't raise money on good terms themselves.
And that sort of sounds to me as if, I sort of feel as if I've spent the last, feels like a decade, probably only 6 or 7 years, looking at the RBA saying, these guys are behind the curve. They keep talking about things are getting better and that, you know, looks like things are getting worse, and they're just sort of keeping current settings and hoping things will get better. But it sounds as if that's almost as if the playbook we're headed for now is, as you said, let's try and taper because everyone else is tapering. We think there's further problems and wages, you know, a number of issues that we are further behind. And I guess what we're hoping for is that China comes back and slams the accelerator on again, and then we won't have to worry about it.
Yeah, I guess so. I think they really want out of, I really genuinely feel they would not have done QE if other central banks weren't doing it. I think QE for them, it's been a successful policy, but it's been a shield, and definitely it was pitched that way. I mean, the problem they had, people forget that the RBA's balance sheet didn't change at all between April and September. In fact, it shrank a bit when everyone else's balance sheet was growing, and that's because the RBA didn't have a tool to increase the size of their balance sheet. They said they'd buy bonds when markets were dysfunctional, and that ended in April. They said they'd buy the yield curve target bonds when those bond yields were too high and the bond yields were around where they wanted them to be, so they didn't have to buy any. And then they had the TFF, and they're not in control of when banks draw the TFF down. So, they promise it to banks, and straight away it goes into the bank's liquid asset portfolios because it's liquids they can get if they need them. But it didn't actually increase the size of the balance sheet.
The repricing happened. They didn't need to.
They didn't draw it down. Yeah. And so the RBA's balance sheet, I mean, like it or not, you know, FX punters are simple people, and, you know, the RBA's balance sheet was sideways to down and everyone else was going up like that. And so the Aussie dollar got stronger. And so they needed QE so they could play the relative balance sheet game, or at least keep up. And they're in the game now and it's been effective, and everyone else is going to slow down their purchases. So I think that they'll slow down theirs. But yeah, in the scenario you painted, there'll be more government debt and the RBA will want the currency down. So I think QE would be a preferred tool rather than the TFF.
Yeah, excellent. US, I guess you've got any other thoughts, sort of big picture US? We've sort of been taking this view that there's a bit of a, you know, there's a lot of money had been pumped into the economy direct to, you know, set out in checks.
Yep.
There's all this infrastructure spending coming, but that doesn't come up, you know, that first of all, hasn't really passed most of it. And secondly, that takes 6 or 12 months before it even gets going, you know, once you go through the planning process. And there's a bit of a gap there. We're just trying to work out, you know, we think it's got enough momentum to sail over it, but maybe if China comes weaker than people are expecting, or there's an energy crisis or something like that, then maybe there's bigger issues. You know, in light of that, I guess, where do you have disagreements, or where do you see?
I think the market's reasonably priced. I think the Fed tapers in Q4, as they've indicated that they will, probably at the next meeting, but could be the December meeting, but most likely at the next meeting. And then starts raising rates in the second half of next year. I think the market's, you know, I think they've guided pretty well there, and it seems likely to me that that's what's going to occur. The risk, you know, for risk from high energy prices, I mean, high energy prices tend to drive investment in the US these days. So I don't think there's too much risk, and they're much more of a closed economy than Australia. So the risks from China, I think, are much reduced, though not eliminated, but much reduced. So the US seems all right to me. They do have it. There's a long way to go until they've replaced all those jobs, and that's the main reason you could see for caution. But things seem to be in place for for it. There's more easy gains, you would think, as things normalize and they open up. So I think the US should be okay.
They're at least the least worst economy.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. And then in terms of the big issue there's been first the continuing resolution and then the debt ceiling. So I took the view that it was a bit of a carnival, I guess, rather than a sideshow, because it's been a big issue. So the Democrats were saying they wouldn't split the continuing resolution, which is the permission for the government to spend from the laws to increase the debt ceiling, and then they'd split the CR off and had that and put that through, avoiding the shutdown. And then they just overnight, Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate leader, offered the Democrats either an expedited reconciliation process or an extension of the debt ceiling for December. And so probably they're going to, it seems like, according to the Twitter sphere, they're probably going to take the extension of the debt ceiling. So that's not really an issue now. So you should, you know, S&P rallied a bit. I think you see a bit of risk premium come out of the market. And that should, you know, you often get a rally this time of year as a seasonal effect, but, you know, those risk factors which are pushing back on a rally are no longer there. I think the US can ignore China for the moment and probably will. So I think should be a pretty risk positive end of the year. I think that probably is bullish for the US dollar.
Europe, I guess they are more heavily tied to China.
They are, yeah.
So
yeah.
I guess your thoughts around issues for Europe?
Yeah, look, I think Europe and the euro. I mean, the ECB is going to make a review of their bond buying policies at the December meeting, which I think is code for they're going to tape it too, because everyone else is. So, and they've been doing a lot. The euro has traditionally been a global growth currency, and was very affected by the trade wars. You can see that in 2018, where the euro came off quite hard. At the same time as global PMIs came down. So if you do have trouble in China, I think euro dollar down, I guess that's where you're going. So it's they'll be slower than the US. I think the US is the growth leader at this point, and Europe will be slower, and the euro will tend to decline.
Mm. Excellent. So I know I keep going for hours, but I'm aware we've taken up a lot of your time.
It's been great.
Anything I've missed? Anything big that I've missed that you're sort of one of your, sitting on your current list of risks or opportunities?
No, that you've covered everything that's on my mind for the moment. So that's been fantastic. Thank you very much for inviting me to be a part.
Yeah. Well, do you want to give a quick, I guess, summary of if people are interested in your work, where they can find it and where they can subscribe?
Sure. I've set up a blog, signalmacro.com, and you can subscribe there for free. Stick in your email address, and you get a notification when I publish something. Consistent with my background, I focus on I'm an Australian. I'm focused on Australia and New Zealand and a bit of global macro, mostly rates and FX, or macro with a rates and FX bent. So you can find my work there, and hope you like it. You can send me an email at matt@signalmacro.com. Please do so. I'd love to hear from you.
Excellent. Lovely. Thanks very much. Appreciate having you on.
Thanks very much.
I'll hand it over to you.
All right. Lovely. Thank you, Matt. It's been very enlightening. I think kind of over my head, but that's okay. I'm sure there are people over there out there will understand what's going on. Question for the week. Have Australian banks captured Australian regulators? So is the tail wagging the dog, or the dog wagging the tail, or which one is it? Once again, thank you, Matt, for coming on our webinar. It's been great having you. And thanks again to all of those of you who watch this episode live. And for those of you who ask questions along the way, and we do welcome your feedback on this webinar or any suggestions for future topics. We do encourage you to like our video and click the bell to be notified if we get some more content up. And you can also follow us on your preferred podcast. If you want to see any of our previous podcasts or webinars, feel free to head over to nucleuswealth.com/content. And thanks again for Damien and myself. We look forward to seeing you joining us at the next webinar next week. Thank you.